Here's some of the things that I suggest to you. Maybe you have your own system for reading poetry, but I have found through watching students in the classroom for 32 years that some of these matters can help readers of poems. If when you get out a poem for the first time, try to discover what's the situation. That's very natural. You see, if someone were to walk into this room, one of the first things that the person automatically would do is, what's the situation here? If they saw us boxing, they'd say, well, I know the situation. So they'd see this and say, okay, somebody's got something to say to a group of people out there. So in the poem, the same thing. Try to know what's the situation. What's going on here? Is somebody throwing baseballs at the moon? What is it? And who is the speaker? Every poem has a speaker. When Robert Frost says, I found a dimpled spider, fat and white on a white heel off, somebody's telling you that. You can guess it's probably not a very small child. So keep that in mind. Who is the speaker and what's the situation? That'll help you to get inside of the poem. And then some of these smaller matters, but very important. Poets, we know one meaning for a word. For example, the word fell. Maybe we might know two. We certainly know it's a past tense of to fall. But if the poet writes, I wake and feel the fell of dark, if you have the attitude that you know the meaning of fell, you're likely not to look that up in the dictionary, and you'll struggle with it or reject it or say, well, how can he write, doesn't write it in plain English, see? But it's quite all right for the poet to use a meaning for fell that we don't know. And that's why the dictionary is extremely important in poems, because oftentimes you're in the presence of somebody who is an expert with words, just as with a painter. They know more about painting. Musicians know more about music and notes, that sort of thing. So diction can be a very critical matter. And if you're in the presence of a poem where with diction that is not your own, the only thing to do is to go to a dictionary and look. You might try to figure it out from the context, and sometimes you'll succeed and sometimes you will not. Hi, Betty, there's some right up here, okay? Poets disorder the syntax. You understand what I'm saying because I'm putting the words in the order that you are accustomed to hearing. But if I reverse that order or disorder the normal syntax, the direction in which the language goes, you can be in trouble. So when you hear, that song, Throw Mother from the Train a Kiss, Dear, has some disordered syntax, and it tricks you a little bit, okay? So that oftentimes happens, and you simply have to work it out. Why does a poet do that? Because she or he might want a certain rhythm, might want to place words in a particular position, so to give them emphasis or to de-emphasize them. So you have to allow that. That's something the poet may do. Poetry? Come in. Do you have enough for that? Uh-huh. Okay. Images, what do you see when you read the language? Figures, I won't talk about that now. Sounds, the rhythm, and the ideas. Okay, so let's get started. Let's see. Well, we might even look at page 16. I'm sorry, that's the first page. Okay. An ant on the tablecloth ran into a garment moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise. His business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his beauty run. Yet if he encountered one of the high's enquiry squad, whose work is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of their dead, isn't given a moment's arrest, seemed not even impressed. But he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses any, and they no doubt report to the higher up at court. Then word goes forth informing. Death's come to Jerry McCormick, our selfless forager Jerry, with a special janissary whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people, lay him in state on the sepal, and balmy with ichor of nettle. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn location and taking formal position with fingers calmly at twiddle, seizes to death by the middle and heaving him high in air, carries him out of there. No one stands around to stare. It is nobody else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. Well, let's look at another insect, okay? There's some poems right on the table. Okay. A considerable speck. A speck that would have been beneath my sight on any bit of paper sheet so white set off across what I had written there. And I had idly poised my pen in air to stop it with a period of ink when something strange about it made me think. This was no dust speck by my breathing blown, but unmistakably a living mite with inclinations it could call its own. It paused as with suspicion of my pen, and then came racing wildly on again to where my manuscript was not yet dry. Then paused again and either drank or smelt with loathing, for again it turned to fly. Plainly with an intelligence I dealt. It seemed too tiny, it should be T-O-O, it seemed too tiny to have room for feet, yet must have had a set of them complete to express how much it didn't want to die. It ran with terror and with cunning crept. It faltered. I could see it hesitate. Then in the middle of the sheet, cower down in desperation to accept whatever I accorded it of fate. I have none of the tenderer than thou collectivistic regimenting love with which the modern world is being swept. But this poor microscopic item now, since it was nothing I knew evil of, I let it lie there till I hope it slept. I have a mind myself, and recognize mind when I meet with it in any guise. No one can know how glad I am to find on any sheet the least display of mine. On 18, there's a short one. We can take a quick glance through on the bottom. The objection to being stepped on. At the end of the row, I stepped on the toe of an inquiet pole. It rose in offense and struck me a blow in the seat of my sense. It wasn't to blame, but I called it a name. And I must say it dealt me a blow that I felt like malice pretense. You may call me a fool, but was there a rule the weapon should be turned into a tool? And what do we see? The first tool I step on turned into a weapon. Well, let's see here. Let's get to It's one you probably all know, and I want to find out if you would be willing to consider it for discussion. Mending wall on 17. How many are tired of mending wall? All right, well, let's take a look at it, and we'll consider it very closely as possible for discussion. Mending wall. Something there is, it doesn't know, a wall that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are lobes and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is a mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it for their cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage arm. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good neighbors make good fences. And if you turn that around to your farmer and say, good fences make good neighbors. No? The onset, let's see, that's... Well, here's one, I think, since probably a number of you are urban people. On page 19, you might want to look at this one. There's some poems up around the table, okay? brook in the city. The farmhouse lingers, though averse to square with the new city street it has to wear a number in. But what about the brook that held the house as in an elbow crook? I asked as one who knew the brook, its strength and impulse, having dipped a finger length and made it leap my knuckle, having tossed a flower to try its currents where they crossed. The meadow grass could be cemented down from growing under pavements of a town, the apple trees be sent to hearthstone flame. Is water wood to serve a brook the same? How else dispose of any mortal force no longer needed? Staunch it at its source with cinder loads dumped down? The brook was thrown down deep in a sewer dungeon, under stone, in fetid darkness, still to live and run, and all for nothing it had ever done, except forget to go in fear, perhaps. No one would know except for ancient maps that such a brook ran water. But I wonder if from its being kept forever under, the thoughts may not have risen that so keep this new-built city from both work and sleep. Some of you might know Minneapolis. There's a stream, Bassett Creek, that enters Minneapolis toward the west, and goes under the city and comes out at the Mississippi River, I don't know how many miles away. And it's always been a very appropriate poem in Minneapolis because a lot of people don't know that, and once they do, that some people even have tried canoeing in there, and one of the television stations made it through once with the camera. You looking for Robert Frost?
Yes.
Aha. There's some poems up here. We've read some. We're going to reorganize now, I guess. So let's see. I think that's enough. Unless there's one that you see that you really want someone to read. Which of those would you like to discuss? Mending? Well, good. Okay. How many would not like to discuss mending law? How many have ever discussed mending law to the point of exhaustion? Well, I see no reason not to do mending law. It's probably the worst discussion of the whole week. Since I didn't force one on anybody else so far in the other session. But here's what we'll do. We'll reorganize into groups of three or four. Okay? And I suggest that if you are with a close mate, a spouse, or somebody that you have been doing poetry with for a long time, you might not meet with that person because you can always get back with her or him and share your mind. So why don't you make it maybe a group here, one back there, how about right in here, a couple over here, can you do that? I'll make you some chairs out here if you want. One other thing I didn't tell you before, but my attitude about teaching is that the proper thing for a teacher to do is ask honest questions. So I have honest questions about these poems. By an honest question, I mean one for which I don't have an answer. I might have a temporary or partial answer, but one that I would still like to hear more thinking about. So I could give you that question right now if you wanted it, but why don't you go with your own questions about the poem? See once where it leads you. Know what the situation is, the speaker is, and try to discover the problems that you have with each other, where you might differ, where you... So ask your questions to find out what the other people think, okay? So, shall we reorganize? A circle. On an earlier day, we had trouble getting a circle quickly. This is what a circle looks like. I think we can pull it a little bit, I think. Come on in. Don't let those people out there, my goodness. They probably have the only truth available.
You want to
Okay, tighten it up so they can get in. All right? And, we can swing this way a little bit.
Well, I'm out there.
know, I could say something there is that doesn't like the closed circle. And that's gaps, where truth can get out. We want a corner, and keep it right here. Are you one of the three?
No.
I don't like that ragged opening. There's one other matter that I didn't mention earlier. I have found to be very helpful in my own reading. When I encounter any text that's somewhat difficult and I'm attempting to explicate it for myself, to recognize different kinds of questions that the text raises or that I should be aware of. A question of fact, for example, in the poem. Who has the apple orchard? You answer that question by reading from the text. This is not only poetry, but anywhere. Simply read it off there. Question of interpretation. What's the something that doesn't love a wall? You can't read that answer out of the poem. And you have to arrive at that answer from finding parts that fit together and that you can reason to. So you say, well, I think this is what the poet means. This is what he said, this is what he means, and a question of evaluation. Do you agree with Robert Frost? That's a question of evaluation. Or what do you think about what he says? That's an evaluation where you're getting the value of. Okay? Do you want to come up here so you can get in a circle? Or?
No, thank you.
No?
Just keep on.
You're going to take notes of it, aren't you? Okay.
No, he's a minister.
I get to ask the first question because you've already had the chance in your groups. My question is this, and I want you to answer blindly with your eyes, not with your mind, so that you're not influencing somebody. Some of you already know who the geniuses are in here, so you're going to vote the way they do, all right? But I want to prevent that. So you have to close your eyes, and when I ask the question, you show with your hand. The question is, does this wall do more to join or to separate the speaker and his neighbor? Those who say that the wall more joins the two, hold up your hand. Okay. And those who say that the wall more separates the two, hold up your hands. You're just about equally divided. Get it settled. We're not leaving until that's settled. Go for it.
The wall separates them, but they would never get together if it hadn't been for the wall.
The wall provides an annual spring ritual of mending and healing.
Speak very loud because some people are almost as deaf as I am.
The wall provides an annual spring ritual of mending and healing, which is a bringing together. It's a strong ritual.
There still is something rankling in this man's mind because he says, I want to approach him about this. Something there is that doesn't know.
He was lazy and he didn't want to
see that out.
He was lazy and he just didn't wanted to get out. He'd rather do something else than mend the wall.
Who was lazy, the speaker or the neighbor?
The speaker.
No, I think he relished that.
Let's see, were you finished with your...
Yeah, I'll take
it back. I think the speaker relished the opportunity to get together. He had a kind of sense of humor about it, working with that guy.
I don't think so. I think it's just the opposite. It irritated him. And to hear that line over and over, good fences make good neighbors, good fences. I get the opposite feeling.
Which is what's expressible? Opposite to what?
Opposite to what she was articulating, that she thought the speaker liked to get together. I think he'd like to get rid of that wall and never have to deal with it and waste his time with it.
I don't think he had to deal with it, though. I mean, he didn't have to go help this guy move this wall, really.
He had to repair it, though. He had to keep doing it. Maybe he want to spend his time that way. I'm sorry, I've got to go. So I'm going to say, we kind of came to the conclusion that the other man, the person who bears the fence, He gets it from his father, and he's following a traditional path of his father, which says that we do this, we have a fence that makes good neighbors. For whatever it's worth, I really have to go. Any reaction?
No, don't go.
I gotta go. They're gonna toss me out of here if I don't.
Go ahead.
Okay.
No, you redo it. No, I went to her.
You may go.
No, someone react before I go.
In one place, he talks about, he says, it just is another kind of outdoor game, one on his side, and it's a little bit, it's just a little more. And we come where we don't need the wall. Down at the bottom, the thing that really, I guess, struck me more than anything, he said, he pictures the man with these rocks and like a old stone savage, and he said he moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go beyond his father's saying.
Mm-hmm. Which argument does that support? That it more joins or more separates?
That it separates, it's not necessary. It's something that he does just because it's a saying that he can't get beyond it. He's moving in darkness. He's not. He's doing it for the wrong reason.
I don't think the author thinks his neighbor is much of a fellow, but he likes the neighborliness of it anyway, and he thinks he's kind of in darkness, doing just what his father did. But I think he still relishes the idea of having the neighbor there and going out every spring with them. Wants to be on good terms with them.
Because he has an obligation. He has to do this if the neighbor wants to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to prepare half of your fence. Each farmer has to provide half the fence. And so the man that likes, father said that's been a good neighbor. If he wants to put it up, the author is obligated to provide help on his side.
Who initiated the mending?
The speaker. He let the person know beyond the hill, which I think agrees
with
that's
right.
The view that he wants to do this. He enjoys the ritual. I think with Bob,
just a minute, a little bit of time. Thanks, Betty. So long. Go ahead.
What it seems to me that bothers him is not the ritual or even the wall, but it's the attitude of his neighbor. He wishes the neighbor could see beyond just good fences make good neighbors. Well, actually, good fences do make good neighbors. It brings them together. But once a year for this time of mending the wall. But it doesn't, I'm trying to explain, but his neighbor doesn't see that deeper level of this wall, what this wall does for them.
So are they more joined by this experience of the wall?
Yeah, that's my...
They joins them, gets them together.
But if they were really good neighbors, wouldn't they meet them more than once a year?
Say that right to him.
if this was something he enjoyed so much and they were such good neighbors, wouldn't he want to meet with them more than once a year?
Mm-hmm.
And over other circumstances, like getting together for dinner or coffee or...
Right.
I don't think that it would have the sacredness of the ritual, and so the healing power of ritual wouldn't be occurring over coffee. There's something really specific about the mending of the fence, the healing property of that. They could be friends and have coffee, but that's outside of this sacredness and spirituality that they would experience through the renewal of that ritual.
You saw that spiritual, sacred healing act in the mending of the wall?
In the ritual, yearly mending of the wall, yes. That from that kind of annual ritual, that there is spirit, that creates a sacred space.
Of two minds?
Yeah.
Show it in the neighbor.
Say what?
Show it in the neighbor.
I'm sorry.
Show in the text where that neighbor has that awareness.
Oh, I don't think he does. Oh, I'll look for it, though.
You already said he did.
I think. I must have misspoken. I think that the fact that they do a mending and it's a ritual, perhaps it's only in the writer. His feeling that between the two of them there is a ritual.
What are the feelings of the neighbor?
I think the neighbor loves his father. loyal. He's faithful and loyal.
Yeah.
And he's heard his father say this, and he's learned the wisdom in his father's teaching, and he believes it.
Is he closer to his neighbor? Is the neighbor closer to the speaker after today than he was before today? But as you read the poem, how do you interpret that? What does Frost want us to think? That they are, that they have been brought closer together, or they have been separated by the wall?
I don't think that anything moves.
I think these are two totally different kind of people, and under any terms, if they had a fence or no fence, they'd never get together. One is a whole got a different kind
except
of...
Except once a year.
Yeah, they'll go to each other's funeral someday, and, you know, if they're really a tough time. But this becomes an occasion, at least, where they get together. But this other fellow, he's not open. He's such a... And Frost is a very open guy, and they're just such opposites. So they're grateful for... Frost is grateful. At least for this thing, we got something, some chance to meet. Because otherwise... He wouldn't talk to me, but he's over here now, you know.
So maybe Frost says that maybe he feels the communion with the other, the neighbor in the ritual mending, and the neighbor re-experiences the relationship with his father if he remembers in the mending of the wall that good fences make, that there's an opportunity for the neighbor as well not to come together necessarily with Frost, but to grow within himself.
But there's real irony in mending a wall rather than mending a relationship. That the end result is that the wall is secure, and they're well protected from each other. But the paradox is that the person of the self and the person is...
Excuse me, I'm not quite hearing you.
The paradox of relationship, as I understand it, is that if you don't have a boundary about yourself, you can't really feel safe about yourself to express yourself.
So you need to mend, you mend the wall, and in so doing, you mend yourself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we do need boundaries. And if you gave all those up, you would be vulnerable to the point that you couldn't function.
Right. Every year they keep this thing that maintains the functioning of their relationship over a long period of time.
And it would assume that that's the limits that this relationship could have.
Right.
But I don't think that there is enough evidence in here that you can't go beyond it. Maybe
he has a way of saying this. You know, he says, I let my neighbor know beyond the hill on a day we meet to walk the line, and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. I mean, he gives it the image of the two men with the wall between them.
But then he goes to say, too, that there is something that doesn't love a wall, as if he's saying, you know, he himself doesn't love the wall, but the neighbor does. He wants the neighbor to say, you know, he could say elves want it down, but he'd rather that the neighbor said for himself that he wants it down. He wants the other one to realize that.
He's the one who calls the neighbor and says, let's get together and fix it.
Right.
Let's pursue that detail some more. Because it relates to what Tom and you were saying. That something, what is the something that doesn't love a wall?
Frost, hunters,
elves, mischievous, elves, unexplainable.
Mm-hmm. Unexplainable?
Yeah, mischievous, elves, well,
dogs,
nature.
Little boys.
I don't know if everybody heard you.
Nature.
Cows.
Well, they don't have any.
But if there were cows, they would just as soon wander over to the neighbor's orchard, probably, rather than stay where they are.
I want only the something of the poem. That's the only something. If you're giving somethings from outside the poem, from your experience, that's not my question. My question is, what is the something that doesn't love a wall that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills upper boulders in the sun so that two can pass abreast? What is it that does that?
Winter. Frost. Yeah, nature and frost.
Frost.
Those of you who say nature, do you agree with Frost that walls are unnatural and that nature truly does not love a wall? Is that how many have a thought on that? Is it true that nature does not have walls or love them?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Nature has walls.
Nature herself has walls.
Would you like, who knows? You say nature does have walls?
Yeah.
Point to one.
There are cliffs, for example, that would, you know, consider a wall to be something that's not, or sort of a division, and nature has natural division.
Patches of cactus.
But it seems like things are always changing in nature, so that if there is a wall, it would be washed away or something. Nature never stands still.
Mm-hmm. The ground swells.
And hunters is another thing that they talk about.
I'm caught by this one passage in here. Maybe I'm wandering off of what you should
be. You probably are, but we'll help you.
Before I built a wall, I asked to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was like to give offense. So in other words, this man does say, in a way I'm offended by it, but he wants to climb the wall. I mean, the wall that this symbolizes. I'm not going to let it be a wall to me. I think it's a fantastic pun, I really do.
Well, offense can be a property division, just a statement of property, not necessarily keeping anything in or out. A lot of people in cities will have a fence or some division for their property and neighbors, and they don't have any livestock or anything to go back and forth. So people just like to say, this is mine on this side, and that's his on this side, and that fence is there. He can't move over on my property because that tells him where his and his property starts.
From your personal experiences, as well as your knowledge of history, would you say that walls have done more harm or good in human relations?
Harm.
Look at the mess they got now that it's done.
I heard harm and a
Great Wall of China didn't do any good. They just went around it.
Does anybody think walls in their lives have done more good than harm?
If you consider a fence wall, yes.
Good what? Good or harm?
Good. Oh. Have to have fences.
Why?
Keep my stock from his stock. We have to have fences. It isn't a matter of choice or...
Depends on where you live.
Yeah. We have to have fences to keep our animals home.
What about in the city?
Keep the dogs in.
How many neighbors would be better neighbors if those fences were down? You all say yes. Huh? Does anybody disagree with that?
What was that on?
In the city, do fences help for neighborliness, or do they impede?
They impede.
They isolate.
If you lived next to a junkyard, or people who had a junky yard, you'd welcome a fence.
Mm-hmm. But not many. If I objected to...
The person that we bought a dog from as a collie, it's beautiful, pedigree. Collie said, "You cannot have this dog unless you build a fence where the dog can live," and that was a good thing.
Well, that's what Ross said. He says he would ask what he's walling in or walling out, and whether it is serving some purpose.
But then, once the fence is there, it's the fence is there, and whether that purpose leaves, the fence is still there. You know, if the fence was built in to wall in the dog, then maybe once the dog is gone, the fence is still there.
Well, I think that Frost agrees that if you have dogs, that you should keep them on your property. Mm-hmm. There's some reason for that.
But this wall in the poem, he says, I have apple orchards and he has pine. I mean, my apple orchards aren't going to cross over and...
So you don't really need it.
Right.
As a mother of four sons, I was very glad to have a fenced-in backyard so I didn't have to sit out there all the time and watch which direction they were going to go.
That's lots of times. That's city.
Yeah. So that was good. to have that fenced-in area, and also then they couldn't run into
the... If you have small children that could run out in the street, they need to have a nice fenced-in play area, but there's a reason for it.
Our kids grew up in the city. It's not a big city, but it's still a city with no fence around it, and the neighbors had 7 children, 4 were boys, and all, but they didn't have problems. We did all know each other. I don't know that we were out
there. But when they have little children, they can run into the street without, after a ball.
The author wants to put some value on, because he's the one that instigated the mending. Either he thought it was expected of him, or else he wanted to meet the other man, but he thought he was valuing that fence, and he was making fun of it. Why am I doing this? But still, I'm causing it to be done.
I have one more question. Who would you rather have as a neighbor, the speaker or the neighbor? I want to do something here. I'm the speaker of the poem, okay? And he's the reader of the poem. He's the reader of the poem, okay? So here I am, I'm telling this story. You know what, Carl? I want to tell you about my neighbor. He is absolutely the dullest, the most ignorant, stupid, unthinking person I've ever lived next to. That's my neighbor. How many of you would like to live to somebody who speaks that way about his neighbor rather than this dull-headed neighbor? It's time to go.